Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, debris located possibly from the missing Malaysian jetliner. EU considering further sanctions against Russia. A call for Egypt to find itself a new bold economic leadership.
These things are very, very difficult to do, but they've been done many times before.
Children finding science can be both informative and fun. And looking into the role of keen eyesight in baseball, it's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Surveillance aircraft patrolled a remote area in the southern Indian Ocean looking for a missing Malaysian airliner after Australia released satellite images of the region showing possible floating debris. The Malaysian defense minister said the photos represented a credible lead in the massive multinational search for the plane, which disappeared on March 8th with 239 people on board. The debris was found 2,500 kilometers southwest of the Western Australian city of Perth. Grainy photos released by Australian authorities showed the indistinct objects floating among the waves, partially submerged in the water. Officials estimate that one of the objects was 24 meters long and the other was 5 meters long. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who first announced the findings today, warned against making presumptions about the nature of the objects, saying it will be extremely difficult to locate them. There have been several false leads in the search. Analysts say the Malaysian plane mystery highlights the need for better regional cooperation in Asia. Rebecca Valley reports from Hong Kong.
After families of missing passengers publicly lashed out against the Malaysian government's handling of the jetliner mystery, authorities in Kuala Lumpur announced they will send delegates to Beijing, where hundreds of next of kin anxiously await reliable findings. The move is a further attempt by the Malaysian government to correct early missteps that have drawn criticism from China, home to the majority of the plane's passengers. But more than focusing on how one country has handled the crisis, analysts say the struggle to find a plane shows the lack of a regionally coordinated response. Nicholas Thomas is a professor of Asian Regional Governance at City University of Hong Kong.
I think it highlights that Southeast Asia, for all of the talk, is still very much a region captured by national policies, national priorities.
Minister-level officials and heads of state in the region routinely participate in regional meetings on security and military affairs through the Association of Southeast Nations, or ASEAN. Regional countries, including China and the United States, also regularly participate in military drills to exchange information and improve capabilities on counterterrorism. But analysts say cooperation on search and rescue missions so far have been largely overlooked. The strongest efforts, analysts say, have come from the Navy, and in 2010, ASEAN foreign ministries passed a declaration on joint search and rescue mission for vessels in distress. The declaration encourages states to create offices for search and rescue missions, share information and provide support in case ships encounter emergencies at sea. But it doesn't include provisions for catastrophic events such as Flight MH370's disappearance. Thomas says one of the obstacles in effectively coordinating search and rescue missions in Southeast Asia is the big divide in capabilities between regional powers.
The more, I guess, difficult areas to chart are usually in those areas of lower capacity.
The United States has been playing a leading role in maritime security in Southeast Asia, and in recent years it has expanded access to military bases in Australia and the Philippines. China doesn't have overseas military outposts, but has been building up its naval capabilities near contested islands in the South China Sea. Li Mingjiang, a security analyst based in Singapore, says China's military modernization could be of help in search and rescue missions.
Over the years, China has built the capabilities. It has now all the hardware available and technologies available as well, satellite, and other monitoring capabilities. So it's just a matter of political decision.
Lee says Southeast Asian countries largely lack the capacities required and will welcome a more active participation by China, just like they've welcomed help from the United States. He says non-traditional security issues, such as coordination on search and rescue missions, are not sensitive subjects. Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong for VOA.
The European Union is readying further sanctions against Russia over its annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. German Chancellor Angela Merkel told her nation's parliament today the EU is prepared to move to level three measures, which would include economic sanctions if the situation worsens. The EU has already imposed travel bans and asset freezes on Russian officials deemed responsible for the incursion into Crimea. On Wednesday, Moscow signed a treaty with local authorities, making Crimea part of Russia. The majority Russian region voted to break away from Ukraine and join Russia in a referendum Sunday that the U.S. and European Union have declared illegal. The U.N. Security Council discussed the Ukrainian crisis Wednesday. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has details.
In the Security Council's first meeting on Ukraine since Crimea voted Sunday to secede and join Russia, council members expressed their strong condemnation of the hastily called vote, which was watched over by thousands of Russian troops. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said this crisis has never been about protecting the rights of ethnic Russians, as Moscow claims, but about redrawing Russia's borders to include Crimea.
The United States rejects Russia's military intervention and land grab in Crimea. These actions, again, violate the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, Russia's own binding agreements, international law, the expressed will of most members of this council, and the letter and spirit of the United Nations Charter.
She also criticized Moscow, telling the council that a thief can steal property, but that does not confer the right of ownership on the thief. Britain's envoy, Mark Lyle Grant, said Russia has annexed part of a sovereign, independent country through the use of military force.
The permanent representative of Russia spoke about this process being in compliance with international law, without outside interference, and through a democratic process. It is hard to know which of these three assertions is the biggest lie.
France's ambassador Gérard Araud criticized Russian claims of proposals to resolve the crisis. He is heard here through an interpreter.
The proposals of the Russian Federation are simple. What's mine is mine, Crimean's mine, and we can talk about what's yours. That's Ukrainian sovereignty. That's the Russian proposal.
Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin denied Ukrainian accusations that Russian troops fatally shot a Ukrainian soldier Tuesday in the port city of Sevastopol. He said Kiev planned the provocation so it could tell its troops to fire against Russian soldiers. He is heard here through an interpreter.
Today, a few of my colleagues referred to an alleged attack on a Ukrainian base. I can tell you again, there has been no attack on any base. There weren't even any Russian soldiers present. Those who were there were unarmed, wearing bulletproof jackets only, members of the self-defense forces.
He also accused senior UN human rights official Ivan Simonovich of giving a one-sided assessment of the human rights situation on the ground following his 9-day visit to Ukraine. Simonovich told the Security Council that while there were some cases of Russians who were harassed or attacked, they were neither widespread nor systemic. Simonovich said a team of 34 monitors has begun deploying to Ukraine. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
President Vladimir Putin said he is not aiming to split up Ukraine, but some ethnic Russians say they still want to join the Russian Federation like Crimea. VOA's Jamie Detmer has more from Donetsk.
It is a frigid evening in Donetsk, Lenin Square, but the cold has not deterred a small crowd from maintaining a weeks-long protest against the new Ukraine government in Kiev. They say they want to join Crimea and break with Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. 70-year-old Denis says the new government in Kiev is making everyone poorer and the people of eastern Ukraine can't live with the politicians of the capital anymore. Vera is 62 years old and says she'd like Donetsk to stay in Ukraine, but that ethnic Russians are being forced to ask Mr. Putin to help because the politicians in Kiev don't care about the east of Ukraine and they just think of themselves. Donetsk is in the heart of the Donbass coalfield and is one of Ukraine's major industrial cities. The activists in Lenin Square are demanding the release of an activist who briefly proclaimed himself People's Governor of the region this month. And they praise the actions of Russian separatists in Crimea, who stormed a Ukrainian naval base in the Crimean city of Sevastopol. This a day after Crimean leaders signed a treaty with Russia, absorbing the peninsula into the Russian Federation after a disputed referendum. Ukraine's new leaders are becoming increasingly anxious about the protests in the eastern Ukraine cities that are home to large numbers of ethnic Russians. Protests have mounted, and over the weekend violence flared when more than 5,000 pro-Russian protesters roamed central Donetsk, smashing doors and windows and forcing entry to government buildings. Three have died in the recent protests in eastern Ukraine. Kiev's politicians claim Moscow has been infiltrating Russian provocateurs to incite much of the agitation, an allegation also levelled by US Secretary of State John Kerry. The Kremlin denies this and has warned it is ready to send forces massed on the border to protect ethnic Russians, the initial reason given for seizing Crimea. Pro-Russian activists deny the claims, flashing Ukrainian passports to show they come from Donetsk. The country's new leaders, who replaced President Viktor Yanukovych, ousted in February after months of street protests against his rule, are trying to dampen ethnic Russian agitation by offering reforms. They are promising greater decentralization while preserving the unity of Ukraine, which will give the region, cities and districts broad powers and the funding needed for their development. But one of the first moves by Ukraine's parliament after Yanukovych fled to Russia still rankles here. The lawmakers passed legislation abolishing a law that allows regions to use Russian as a second official language. The acting president vetoed that abolition, but ethnic Russians point to it as evidence showing what Kiev really thinks of them. Atom, a 36-year-old small businessman, says it is too late for reforms. Donetsk should be part of the Russian Federation and says that would be best. Despite President Putin's indication Tuesday that he has no more designs on Ukrainian territory, Ukrainians fear that he may now be preparing more land grabs of ethnic Russian-dominated areas. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
Paul Salem with the Middle East Institute writes, it was the dire economic situation that created the pressure for the uprising in Egypt. And in his article, Egypt Needs Bold Economic Leadership, he says the economy needs to be reversed in the next few years. We spoke with the research analyst about the situation in Egypt.
Well, the economic indicators were troublesome before the uprisings began. And as happens in all transitions when there's unsettled situations, changes of government, uncertainty. Usually the economic indicators get worse before hopefully at some point they start to get better. Egypt's economic indicators in terms of GDP, deficit, public debt, unemployment, poverty, over the last 3 years have gone from bad to worse. And what the article highlights is that, you know, if they continue to get worse and that if there isn't any serious turnaround and quickly, these indicators are reaching sort of those red lines and limits, which are very, certainly very dangerous.
Yes, you say in your article, Egypt might fall over a, quote, economic precipice. Well, what needs to be done to prevent that from happening?
Well, there's the short term and the long term. In the short term, some of it is being done in terms of quick support for the state budget, maintenance of programs that maintain the welfare of a population, much of which is desperately poor, but is still surviving. And that is sort of what we've seen in some of the aid that's come from some of the Gulf countries, which has been very important and very welcome, because you need to sort of keep public deficits under control, keep the debt under control, keep the sort of the economy turning over. But what I indicate in the article, that what needs to be done more fundamentally and which will then have the more long-term and more profound impact, is a transformation. A new direction of economic leadership in Egypt. The system that existed in Egypt for several decades, as I describe it in the article, is a crony capitalist system which has some levels of growth, but the growth is limited. The marketplace is mainly controlled by the central government and those close to it. The profits generally go to a small coterie of people. This is a type of growth that's better than no growth, but does not unleash the wider and deeper economic forces that really can bring higher rates of growth, much higher levels of investment, and the numbers of jobs that are needed by this enormous population. So what needs, a lot of focus in Egypt is about the politics, the Muslim Brotherhood, General Sisi, and what's going on politically. But at the end of the day, as you know the saying goes, it's the economy which will sink or enable this, you know, sink or swim this this system in general. And the economy needs to be transformed to become more open, more competitive, but at the same time, reform the subsidies to make them target the poor who really need them and not to be bankrolling classes and elites that do not need those subsidies that currently benefit greatly from them.
This could take quite a while to do. Will the public get unhappy again, and will it fail before it even begins?
Well, that's certainly the challenge. These things are very, very difficult to do, but they've been done many times before in Asia. It was done recently in Turkey. This is not an untrodden road. It's not an unknown direction to go to. In some sense, Egypt might have an opportunity. And at the end of the day, this needs leadership. Right now, there might be, the General Sisi, who is, you know, likely to be Egypt's next president. For a brief period, he will enjoy sort of a wide amount of support. If he can use that political support to put forward a bold economic vision for Egypt rather than simply going back to the old crony economics that existed under Mubarak, if he can, you know, enunciate and put forward a bold economic vision that Egypt is going to move forward rather than reconstruct what existed in the past, this is something that at the end of the day benefits those who need jobs, benefits the youth, benefits the poor. It's only real and serious economic growth that's going to lift people out of poverty.
Paul Salem, Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute. His article is titled, Egypt Needs Bold Economic Leadership. The newly installed chairperson of the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has announced further cutbacks to its economic stimulus for the U.S. economy. In her first press conference Wednesday, Janet Yellen also hinted there could be a rise in short-term interest rates from record lows.
The committee states that in determining how long to maintain the current 0 to 1/4% target range for the federal funds rate, it will assess progress, both realized and expected, toward its objectives of maximum employment and 2% inflation.
Her words were the clearest indication to date of when the Federal Reserve might raise its benchmark short-term rate. The central bank said it would cut its monthly long-term bond purchases by another $10 billion to $55 billion because it thinks the economy is strong enough to support further improvements in the job market.
The central tendency of the unemployment rate projections has shifted down by about 2/10 since December and now stands at between 6.1% and 6.3% at the end of this year. The unemployment rate is projected to reach its longer-run normal level by the end of 2016.
Federal Reserve Bank decisions often play a key role in global economic affairs. Hands-on creations from robots to rockets were highlighted at a Northern Virginia Maker Fair. Artists, inventors, and hobbyists shared their knowledge of things they make themselves, which included science innovations. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to the fair in Reston, Virginia, where children discovered that science can be both informative and fun.
I just like to sew.
With metallic conductive thread, this girl creates a simple electronic circuit. Artist Sally Byers incorporates tiny lights like this in her clothing designs. She says the art of making things yourself is disappearing and hopes the younger generation will continue to create whatever moves them.
I want them to learn that they can make it happen, whatever it might be. They can do all kinds of stuff, but I'm not sure they learn that at school.
But they can learn it at maker fairs, which began in the United States 8 years ago as a gathering for people who enjoy creating and sharing. Now the fairs have spread worldwide to countries like Nigeria, China, and Egypt. Lorelei Brown, media coordinator for this event, says fairs provide an outlet in a world full of ready-made goods.
This kind of thing gives people an incentive to go do something and to maybe change something or think differently.
Robots were popular at the fair. Drones that flew, and robots designed like the Mars rover that the children could control. Engineer Ivan Galish says the robot can be built from a kit.
So they actually have a rocker suspension system designed to go over rough terrain, uneven terrain, and keeping all the four wheels on the ground.
9-year-old Mamun Kolovos enjoyed learning about the robots.
How they go through the ramps and how fast you can make it go or rotate it around.
These kids are propelling pieces of plastic representing small rockets. The display is sponsored by a high school team that builds high-powered motorized rockets. Senior Allison Yu shows off their homemade creations. She says the team did a project with NASA, the U.S. Space Agency.
Our body tube is made out of a cardboard-like material. Because we design our own pieces, we bought the materials and then also cut them ourselves. The rocket that we did for our project went to about 3,600 feet.
Yu plans to become a rocket scientist. Fair organizers hope today's activities launch lots of the young people here into exciting creative careers. Deborah Block, VOA News, Reston, Virginia.
The 2014 Major League Baseball season begins later this month. Players have been preparing at spring training camps in Florida and Arizona, working on fundamentals and building speed and endurance. When it comes to their vision, many never bat an eye. Professional baseball players have some of the best eyesight in the world, and scientists are documenting just how this vision leads to a winning game. At the so-called Cactus League in Arizona, Shelley Schlender reports from Phoenix.
At the Cleveland Indians training camp, the pitcher throws and Luigi Rodriguez says batting takes practice and good vision.
The ball is a little small, so you gotta have your eyes, you know? Look at the pitcher's arm to see where he's gonna throw the ball.
Ophthalmologist Daniel Labby says most major league batters have incredible eyesight.
So the normal average person can see something from 3 meters, where the baseball player sees from 6 meters. They can be twice as far away and still see the same targets.
Labby and ophthalmologist David Kirshen are pioneers in the science of sports and sight.
So we have the opportunity to work with the vision for several sports, and it turns out it's a key component in some sports and not as important in others.
Like boxing.
Because their target is very large and very close, but they have to be able to move their hands very, very quickly.
Batting is a different story.
Just when it's released from the pitcher's hand, they have to see the spin of the seams. And based on that spin pattern, they know what pitch it is. When you know what pitch it is, you know where it's going to come. Once you know where it's going to come, you can put the bat in the right place to make a good hit.
To turn normal eyes into super eyes, many players, like Cleveland Indian Jake Lowry, wear corrective contact lenses.
It helps me see the pitches, see the seams on a ball. Helps me keep the brightness down when the sun's out.
The standard eye chart is not good enough to test athletes, Kirshen and Labby say. They've designed this test where a computer flashes a tiny letter C and the athlete sits several meters away. Labby demonstrates.
And that one is to the left side. That one I couldn't tell, so I'm going to guess. For me as an eye doctor, very, very difficult. But the baseball players seem to see most all of these.
Kirshen says this test might help identify people who need more training for faster response.
And when you think of elderly drivers, for instance, they may be able to see like an eagle, but they can't process it fast enough to be a safe motorist.
And it might give budding athletes a better chance.
I want to be a baseball player when I grow
up. And if you have a young child who's interested in playing baseball, and they're trying their best in the field, but they just don't see well enough, the coach won't spend as much time with that player as they will with the player who's doing very well.
He says testing eyesight and getting people the correction they need can help everyone do better at their game, whatever it is. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Phoenix, Arizona.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 20th, 1815, Napoleon entered Paris with his army after escaping from exile, beginning his so-called 100 Days Rule. 5 days later, some leading nations in Europe formed a coalition to remove Napoleon from power, thus setting off the Napoleonic Wars. The series of conflicts ended in defeat for Napoleon and his return to exile. On this day in 1852, American abolitionist and author Harriet Beecher Stowe published her classic book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. The novel had a profound effect on public opinion concerning black slavery in the American South. In 1854, the Republican Party of the United States was organized in Ripon, Wisconsin. In 1904, behavioral psychologist, author, and philosopher B.F. Skinner was born in Susquehanna, Pennsylvania. In 1942, U.S. General Douglas MacArthur, following a harrowing escape from approaching Japanese forces in the Philippines, vowed, "I will return." 2 years later, in 1944, MacArthur headed the American Army that liberated the Philippines from Japanese control. In 1967, the Motown girl group known as the Supremes released this hit song. The Happening was the theme song for a movie of the same name. The movie flopped, but the song reached number one on Billboard magazine's Hot 100 in May of that year. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns Russia's efforts to annex Crimea. It is a blatant violation of international law. In response to the recent illegal referendum in Crimea, President Barack Obama announced a series of sanctions on specific individuals responsible for, among other things, undermining the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine or its democratic processes or institutions. President Obama also signed a new executive order focused on Russian activities related to the crisis in Ukraine, authorizing sanctions on, among others, individuals and entities operating in the arms sector in Russia and individuals who provide material support to senior officials of the Russian government. The United States stands ready to impose further sanctions if and as necessary. The U.S. is continuing to consult with its European allies, who have also imposed sanctions against Russia. As NATO allies, said President Obama, we have a solemn commitment to our collective defense, and we will uphold this commitment. Further provocations will achieve nothing except to further isolate Russia and diminish its place in the world, said President Obama.
The international community will continue to stand together to oppose any violations of Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. And continued Russian military intervention in Ukraine will only deepen Russia's diplomatic isolation and exact a greater toll on the Russian economy.
President Obama underscored there remains a clear path for resolving this crisis diplomatically. The United States stands with the people of Ukraine and their right to determine their own destiny. The U.S., along with the international community, will not stand quietly by while one country forcibly seizes the territory of another. The United States calls on all members of the international community to take concrete steps to impose costs on Russia and to stand together in support of the Ukrainian people and Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.